We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, our spiritual advisor. In the early days, they took this step with other people. But it is better to meet God alone than one who might misunderstand. Force was quite optional as long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. Now he gives us the results of step three. Step three, this was only a beginning. Though if honesty and humming made an effect, sometime a great one was felt at once. Now in the case of the sudden spiritual experience, on these occasions, we have a great, but in most cases, step three, we don't get a great effect out of step three. Because step three is just the beginning. It's the first step in recovery. Now we'll find out after we go through the steps and study the results of each step. He will tell us how to take the step. Now first he tells us why we need to take it. He uses us. First he will tell us every step, three through all on the last steps, the recovery steps. He will tell us why we need to take it. Then he will tell us how to take it. And then he will tell us what we should get out of it. Now, and we'll, as we go through the steps, we will see that. Now, after we get into step five, we find out that we get a lot more out of step five than we do step three. Now, step three is just a thinking step. We don't get too much out of the thinking steps. It's a decision to do something. We don't really do anything. And we get more out of step five, which is an action step. And we can compare the action when we get to step five, and we find we get a lot more out of step five because it's an action step than the step three, which is just a decision to do something.
Let's take about a 10-minute break, and then we're going to jump right into four. From here on, things start to move rapidly now. After we have finished step three, the book says next we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. I think there's two things here we need to look at. First, he put a time element on the starting of step four. People today say, well, how long should you be sober before you do step four? How long should you wait? And Bill says you do step four at once after you do step three. And that does make sense. Four always did follow three. So what he's really saying is, if you've completed three, there's no need to wait around any longer, that we should at once go into step four. And I think that's true for two reasons. Number one, if we take step three the way the book says, if we really understand this self thing and see why we need to give it up, then in step three, through the prayer, we will lose some of our self-will. Probably just enough of it to let us get on with step four. But if we procrastinate and wait around too long, self-will will come back. And it'll say, well, we really don't need to do this. Or it'll say, I don't know how to do this. Or it'll say such things as, I'm afraid to do this. And self-will will again block us off from taking step four. So the sooner we get on with it, the better. Now, the purpose of it is to get rid of those things which are going to block us off from God's will. You know, God's always been here. And I've been here for 58 years. And there's always been God's will, and there's always been my will for 58 years. And I could have always been operating on God's will. But I never did, because I operated on self-will. There were certain things within me that's always blocked me off from God's will. Now, if I can't find those things and do something about their elimination, then there's no way I can operate on God's will. You can't do anything about a problem until you identify the problem. And just saying, God, here it is, it really doesn't work. Because there's certain things within my head that blocks me off from God's will. And if I can find those and remove them, then maybe I can begin to listen to God's will instead of self-will. It said, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. And I think here we need to look at the word inventory. Lots of question in AA, should it be written? Should it be mental? Should we take a little here behind this podium and a little there behind that podium? I think the first thing we need to realize is inventory is defined as a written list of items. If you're in your kitchen, you're getting ready to go to the store, and you look through the shelves to see what you need to buy at the store, and you come out of the kitchen, somebody said, what are you doing in there? You might say, well, I've been inventorying my food stocks. No. If you didn't make a written list of items, you just been in the kitchen looking around. You really didn't take an inventory at all. So there's no such thing as a mental inventory. The dictionary does define it as a written list of items. I think our biggest problem with the inventory has been this. Two basic things. One, those of us that have taken it like to play king off of the mountain and like to tell the newcomer how hard step four really is. And we've done it, and by God, you're going to have to do it, and it's going to be tougher than hell when you get... No wonder nobody wants to take the damn thing. We scare the hell out of them with it. I think another thing that's wrong with it is we simply never did understand how to do it. And the instructions on it in the big book are very, very short, very simple. So simple that for years, most of us have overlooked them. So not knowing how to take the inventory and not being able to find it in the big book, we searched for other ways. And we got to step five, and it said something about all your life story in step five, and we jumped on it. And we said, that's what they mean. Maybe we should sit down and write all our life story. We let five determine what we were going to do in four. And many of us wrote all of our life story. And I did mine and got on, and I don't know how many pages it was, but a bunch of them. And I took it to a fellow to take step five with, and he read it, and he said, not very pretty, is it? And I said, no. And he tore it up and he threw it in the trash can and he said, you don't have to be that way anymore. And I didn't learn a damn thing. The reason I didn't learn anything is first, everything I wrote down I already knew. So I didn't learn anything new by writing it down. And also I realized that most of the stuff I wrote down didn't have anything to do with my drinking at all. 95% of it had nothing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was born in 1929, I don't think that had a thing to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I graduated from high school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I don't think that had anything to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I went into service when I was 17, I really don't think that had anything to do with my alcoholism. The fact that I was married when I was 21, I don't think that had anything to do with my alcoholism. Most of the stuff that I wrote down was absolutely wasted anyhow, because most of it had no bearing on my alcoholism at all. So in our confusion, since that didn't work, we searched out another way to do it. And somebody up in Minnesota wrote a fourth-step inventory guide. And we thought, now there it is. And we got that guide, and we mixed it with the big book, and we just got more confused. So that didn't work either. And a fella in Dallas wrote another four-step inventory guide. So we got the one out of Dallas, the one out of Minnesota, and the big book, and mixed them together, and that didn't work either. And today, I don't know how many four-step inventory guides are floating around, but a hell of a bunch of them. Joe and I ran into one up in Canada, and I'll guarantee you, if you wasn't crazy as hell before you took it, you would be when you were through with it. I never saw anything like that in my life. So it's just been utter, complete confusion. And all the time, the instructions have been right here in the book. But you got to realize two things to understand it according to the book. Number one, it's very, very simple. And we alcoholics with our complicated minds have always looked for something more complicated than it really is. And we just glossed over the simple little instructions in the book. I think also we got to realize that Bill had a certain way to write. And we've been looking at it all the way through, that he loved to compare words. He loved to paint pictures in our mind by the use of words. He loved to use parables to teach. And we had another great writer that did that a couple thousand years ago. You know, this other great writer in the big book, whenever he wanted to teach something to a fisherman, he would tell him a little story about fish. And he would get his point across because the fisherman understood it. When he wanted to get the same point across to the shepherd, he changed from fish to sheep. Then when he went to the farmer, he talked about grains and cattle, always talking in the language of those he was trying to teach so they would understand his point. Bill does the same thing in the big book. He assumes that you and I know a little bit about an inventory. And in the next two paragraphs, he's going to talk about two inventories. He's going to talk about a personal inventory, but in order to talk about it, he's going to talk about a business inventory. And then he's going to compare the two together. And he's going to make his point to us in talking about this commercial or business inventory. Let's watch him very closely and see his use of words. He said, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory and immediately jumps into a business inventory. He said, this was step four. And then he said, a business, which takes no regular inventory, usually goes broke. So he's comparing personal to business in those two sentences. Assuming that you and I know a little something about a business inventory, and I think we probably do. You know, we know that the inventory in a business is what they've got inside that business. But it doesn't make any difference whether they're in the business of selling ladies' purses, men's shoes, bicycles, whatever it is. If they don't inventory their stuff from time to time, they'll probably end up broke. Because if they don't inventory, they will not know what's been stolen out of the store. They won't know what's been sold out of that business. They won't know what's become damaged and unsaleable. They won't know what's become out of style and nobody wants to buy it. They won't know what it's necessary to put on sale so they can get rid of it. Nor will they know what they need to order new to put back in the business to have something to sell to people. And if they don't inventory once in a while, a business will normally go broke. And I think the first recognition is this, that you and I have a business also. It is a personal business. And it's probably the most important business in the world as far as we're concerned. And that's the business of finding a way to live where we can be peaceful and happy and free and not have to go back to drinking. Because going broke for you and I in our business of sobriety is simply going back to drinking alcohol. And chances are if we don't take a personal inventory, that we'll go broke in our business too. Or we will go back to drinking just exactly like a business inventory will go broke also. Now let's see what he said. He said, taking a commercial inventory, see, he won't repeat himself. He said business just before, but now he said commercial. Means the same damn thing. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact finding. Now, let's compare that with our step. Our step says we made a searching. And compare the word searching to the words fact-finding. They mean identically the same thing. So whether we're talking about a business or a personal, we're talking about a searching or a fact-finding, both meaning the same thing. In the commercial inventory, he said, it is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. In our fourth step, it says, we made a searching and a fearless. Now, fact-facing and fearless are the same identical thing. You see what this guy does? Oh, he loves to do this. He loves to do it. And that's exactly what he's doing here. Now, in the commercial inventory, he said it is an effort to discover the truth. In our fourth step, he said we made a searching and fearless moral. And I think there's where we went wrong. Because we jumped on that word moral, and we said, oh, shit, there it is. There's that list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. I'm really not sure what all Bill Wilson knew. But I'm sure one thing, this guy knew the English language. And I believe if he had wanted you and I to make a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things, I think he would have said we made a searching and fearless amoral or searching and fearless immoral inventory. He didn't say that. He said moral. Now, we go to the dictionary and we look up the word moral and we'll find one definition is truth. So the word moral in our fourth step is the same as the word truth in this commercial inventory. Now, it is an effort to discover the truth about what? About the stock in trade. In the commercial inventory, you and I know what the stock in trade is. It's what is in the store. The stock in trade is the items that he has for sale. Some on shelves, some in display cases, some on top of cabinets, some just sitting out in the middle of the floor. The stock in trade is what he has to sell. Now, what he wants to know is what's damaged, what's out of style, what do I need to get rid of, what do I need to put in place of it. Now, his stock in trade, he's probably got borrowed money. And if he's got borrowed money and he's paying interest on it and his shelves are filled with stuff that will not sell, he's going broke. But if he can find out what needs to be replaced, he can get rid of those, put new items in, and then chances are he'll be able to have a successful business. Now, mine and your business of staying sober, we also have a stock in trade. Step four says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. We are the stock in trade in our business of staying sober. And the only stock in trade that you and I have got to sell is how we think. How many times have we heard stinking thinking leads to drinking? If my thoughts are right, then chances are I'll be successful and stay sober. If my thoughts are lousy, then my stock in trade is damaged. Some of it's unsaleable. Some of it's damn sure out of style. And chances are bad thinking will lead me to drinking. So I'm going to inventory the only stock that I have for sale in my little store, and that's how I think. And as I compare these words, I like to look at my head as being a little store. And I've got some items out here on the floor of it. I've got some of them on display in cases. I've got some of them up here on shelves. And I've got some of them hid away. Some of them are so damaged and unsaleable, I don't want you or anybody else to see them. Now, the same thing is true with my stock in trade as with this business inventory stock in trade. Whether he goes broke tomorrow or not will not be determined by what he had in his store 20 years ago. Whether he goes broke tomorrow or not will not be determined by what he's going to put in his store 20 years in the future. Whether he goes broke tomorrow or not will be determined by his stock in trade in his store as of today. Now, mine and your stock in trade is the same way. Whether I go broke tomorrow or not, whether I get drunk tomorrow or not, will not be determined about how I thought 20 years ago. Nor will it be determined about how I'm going to think 20 years in the future. It's going to be determined by how I think right now, today. If my thinking is right today, chances are I'll be sober tomorrow. If my thinking is not right today, chances are I'll be drunk tomorrow. So as I inventory, I'm going to search out and look at my stock in trade, what's in my store as of today. Now let's see what I'm really looking for. If the owner of the business, or one object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. He's looking for not good items as much as he's looking for bad items. The things that nobody wants to buy. The things that are damaged, unsaleable, out of style. And to get them out of his store as soon as he can and open up those shelves so he can put new items back in. Now, mine and your job is going to be the same way. We're going to look for our damaged and unsaleable goods. Those that are completely out of style. Those that nobody wants to fool with. And the main object will be to find them, get rid of them, open up our shelves, so new items can come in. Nowhere in my book does it tell me to look for my assets. It tells me to find those things that block me off from God's will. It tells me to find the damaged and unsaleable goods and to get rid of them promptly. I don't need to look for my assets. Deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. All of the good things of God are in each one of us. We've never been able to use them before. Because in our search for money, power, and prestige, and sex, we have depressed those things and covered them up with these damaged and unsaleable goods. But if I could get rid of those things that we call liabilities, then maybe those assets can come to the surface. And we're going to find as we progress through here, all of this God that dwells within each of us can now begin to come to the surface. And we'll automatically know what we need to do. So nowhere in my book do I have to find those assets. They will come as the result of following these directions. He said, we did exactly the same thing with our lives. In other words, you and I are going to do exactly what the business inventory did. We're going to look for our damaged and unsaleable goods, and we're going to try to get rid of them promptly and without regret. We took stock honestly. We took stock truthfully. We took stock morally. All three of those mean the same identical thing. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Not the assets, but the flaws which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Resentment is one of the symptoms of a person who is spiritually sick. It is a manifestation of a selfish, self-will run riot person. People that run on God's will don't have resentments. People that run on self-will who are spiritually sick will always have resentments. Now, when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Now, that should later rest forever, whether we're going to take a written inventory or not. If we're going to set them on paper, we're going to have a piece of paper, a pencil, a pen, a paintbrush, a typewriter, a computer, some way to put this stuff down on that piece of paper. And I think before we list resentments, let's see what a resentment really is. And I think when we see what it really is, we can see where it is one of those damaged and unsaleable goods that we need to get out of our store.
Hey, it begins here with the resentments. And as Charlie said, I think that we just like it step three. The more we can understand these things, the better we can get into them. You know, resentment comes from a word. It's a lot of the, like the words are self-explanatory in a lot of cases. And that of resentments, when we ever see re, like resentment, the same as replay, repeat, that means again. We see that on the word, it means over, again. And it also comes from the word centire, S-E-N-T-I-R-E, which means to feel. So resentment actually means to re-feel, or to feel over again. And when something occurs in our life, and by the way, we're going to look at, later on, we'll be looking at it, when somebody threatens me, if somebody hurts my self-esteem, as self, if somebody interferes with my companionship, or they interfere with my security, or they interfere with my sex life, it hurts. They strike self. Something outside of me strikes self. When self is struck, and it hurts. And that's a wrong. That's not a resentment. That's a wrong on wherever it come from, and it's going to happen. And once that happens to the alcoholic, once self is struck, it hurts. And then he goes over to the next room, and he replays it over again. He sits there, and he reacts the whole scene out, reacts the scene to hurt himself the second time.
To refeel
the pain. Now, the second time, the first time it's wrong, the second time it's a refeel, it's a resentment. And then he goes on home, and he plays it over again. Now, each time he refills it, it just happened once. But the next time he does it, it's a do-it-yourself job. Now, every time he does it over, he has to intensify it a little bit. And he has to add a little something to it, you know, to color it up. And the more he plays it, the more distorted it gets, and to where it even didn't even resemble what really happened. But he don't know this, because the truth is, you know, we human beings, we need to talk about that. We don't know the truth. None of us know the truth. We just, only truth that we have in any moment of our life is the truth as we perceive it. Amen. And the more we play this over, the worse it gets. And it seemed like we're going to learn out in a few pages why we're doing this. It's really, everything's got a purpose. And the more we play this, the worse that person got who done it. And the worse they get, the better we got. You know, I was standing there doing nothing. Yeah. Yeah. And we play this over and over again. And to refill the pain, trying to retry something of a fort of court of life. Trying to retry it, you know. The world ain't interested. Look at here. Look what they did. Trying to get another trial on it. You know? Trying to change something. Trying to change the past. It's already happened. You know? And the more we replay this, the worse it gets. And it's sort of like I always talk about this. It's like the football game tomorrow today. When a guy across the field, he gets hit and it knocks him down and it knocks the wind out of him and hurts him. Probably he don't get out of the game. Probably it pumps some more air in him. He'll keep on playing. But the announcer don't do that. The announcer, they'll be running another play. Announcer said, let's look at that again. And he's got a resentment machine. One of those replays. one of those replay machines, you know. And he plays it over. This time he slows it down, you know, in slow motion and color. And you can see the pain on the guy's face. Yeah. It was a lot worse than it was the first time. Then later on he said, let's look at it again. He shows it all. You know. Now the alcoholic gets up every morning and he turns his video player on, tunes it up. And for some reason or another, he only records the bad stuff. In fact, he gets to be such an artist that if he can't find out what anything to record, he records what people are thinking about him. Now that's the height of self-will when you know what someone else is thinking. That's about as sick as you can get. And he records all these things and he brings them home at night. Don't, and plays them and makes himself sick. Now that's a way, that's a sick, I'll tell you what we're doing, that's a sick person. Yeah. We're socially sick. That's our social instinct is out of control. Our companionship, our self-esteem is being threatened. Our ego is sick. And when our ego is not being satisfied and our social instinct is not being satisfied, then that's the one sick way of building it up, because when the whole world picks on you, you must be somebody. And we build our sick ego by making ourselves victims of our society. And then, you know, it produces one of the worst emotional illnesses that we individuals can have, and that's self-pity. Because it's like a boomerang. Once you resent another person, If you get it strong enough, you'll finally come back and resent yourself. If I hadn't been here, it never would have happened. And if I hadn't, you resent your own position in life, because if you hadn't been in that position, it never was occurred. So resentments always bring on self-resentments, finally. And we alcoholics, I think that's the number one offender. An alcoholic loves self-pity. You know, sometimes he feels uncomfortable when he doesn't have it. You know, really, sometimes you're so used to it. And if you want to make an alcoholic mad, you try to feel sorry for him. He'll tell you, that's my damn job. He don't want nobody else feeling sorry for him. So we can never be happy with resentment. It is strictly a way to be unhappy and strictly a way to lose. So resentment, and this is our number one offender. In other words, the majority of the time, the most predominant thing that we do is resent others and ourselves. Self-pity may be the number one thing, but this is the thing that dominates our mind, the majority. Our number one discomfort is resentment.
The stupidity in this whole thing is this. When they do it to me, now it may be a wrong on their part, and it may be their fault when they did it to me. I'm going to find out later on it usually isn't, but it might be. And they hurt me, and the first time they do that, that's their fault. But the stupidity is, when I go home and I replay that in the privacy of my own kitchen, and by God, I'm doing it to myself. Hell, they may be on the other side of the country by now, having a hell of a good time, and yet here I am making myself sick by playing this thing over and over and over and over and over, over, just tell God came into our mind like that. So I think if we remember that resentment is a symptom of spiritual sickness that blocks us off. Anything that blocks us off from God's will causes spiritual sickness. And a resentment itself is not the spiritual sickness, it is a symptom of a spiritual malady or a spiritual illness. Now, let's see how we're going to look at this thing and what we're going to do with resentments. Nobody wants to get rid of them until you absolutely have to. Hell, they are fun. Christ, they're a lot of fun. You can just spend hours and hours in that deal. He said, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed institutions or principles whom we were angry. Okay, you've got a sheet in your handout material.
Yeah.
And on page 65 in the big book, there is an example that's going to correspond with the sheet you got in your handout thing called a review of resentments. Now, we want to emphasize this is not anything new. We're not trying to bring another four-step inventory guide into AA. We got enough of those already. But what you've got is page 65, blank. The first column says, I'm resentful at. The second column said, the cause. The third column says, affects my. And what we did in the third column is, using the same terms that Bill has used, we divided that third column into three basic instincts of life. We subheaded under that, self-esteem and companionship under the social instinct. Under the security, we subheaded material and emotional. Under sex, we subheaded hidden or acceptable and hidden. Now, we've got to recognize that many of us have got two sex lives. One in our own homes that society looks at and says, that's good. And one on the side that we really don't want anybody to know about. And we might be wanting to keep that one hidden. But if you threaten my sex life, either in my own home or with my girlfriend, neither one, I'm going to be madder than hell about it. And then we listed the ambitions. And we've all got plans for the future. We've all got ambitions regarding recognition by other people, social instinct. All got plans regarding security, material and emotional. And all got plans regarding our sex lives. My God, we spend enough time thinking about it and fantasizing about it and trying to change it. So we all have ambitions in those areas. The fourth column, if you would temporarily fold it under where you can't see it, we're going to use it in a couple more pages where it says, what's the exact nature of my wrongs, faults, mistakes, defects, or shortcomings? You'll then see only the three columns, just like page 65. On your first instruction in the book on filling that thing out, it said we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry.
Period. Stop.
Stop right there.
Stop.
That's the first instruction.
First instruction.
So let's go to the first column, start at the top of it, and make that list. Going from top to bottom. Don't try to work from left to right. Because if we do, we got to list the name, then the cause, and then the part of self. Then we got to come back to the second one, and you do about three or four of those, and it just gets circling around in your head. Anybody can make a list of people. That's self-explanatory. Institutions. That's such things as the police department, the Internal Revenue Service, the post office, the church house, all those institutions, or the principles. Principles are such our old laws, really. They're old spiritual, usually, laws of nature. Like, what goes up must come down. God, that's one I always hated. Another one is, what you give out is what you're going to get back. Another one is, there are no free rides. There's a set of them called 10. That most of us had a little difficulty with. And we list those principles. Now, this isn't difficult to do. Nor do you have to be sober very long to do this. I've never seen an alcoholic yet that couldn't sit down with you and tell you exactly who and what they're mad at. God, you can do it just bing, 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 just like that. And if you can't write, all you got to do is feed the names to somebody else and have them put them down for you, going from top to bottom. You can do this within 3 or 4 or 5 days after getting sober. This isn't that difficult to do.
You've been sitting on a bar telling somebody else for the last 10 years.
Yeah. So it really shouldn't be very hard to write it down on a piece of paper. And we fill out column 1, and I think for most of us, we realize something that's very important to us. I've always known that resentment, anger, created a problem for me. I've always known that I made decisions based upon anger and took actions based upon anger, which caused problems for other people, which in turn caused them for me. But I never really knew how much anger dominated my thinking until I put it all down on a piece of paper. If you had asked me beforehand, how many resentments do you have, I'd have said, well, maybe, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8. But when I started listing them, my God, it went page after page after page after page after page, and I suddenly began to realize, hell, I'm mad at everything. No wonder anger gives me a problem. Now, if anger dominates my thinking, then God can't. I made a decision in step 3 to let God direct my thinking, but if anger does it, then God can't. So the first thing I realized is how much anger dominates me. Bill put down 4 names. I think he probably just didn't want to use any more space in the big book. The sheet you've got has 8 names on it, or 8 spaces. And I'm sure all of you can get yours down on that one sheet. But I end up with 172 or something like that. A hell of a lot of it. When I finished that column, I then went to the next instruction. Next instruction says, we ask ourselves why we were angry. The column 2, the cause of the anger. And very carefully we write down to the side of each name why we're mad at them. Now, you may have multiple causes by one name. If so, list multiple causes. But we very carefully, again, work from top to bottom, going to each name and put down the cause of the anger to the side of it. In Bill's example on page 65, he said he's mad at Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, and my wife. Then he came back and wrote down the causes. Now, he's mad at Brown because of his attention to my wife, told my wife of my mistress, and Brown might get my job at the office. You know, I don't really blame him. I'd be getting a little upset with Brown about now, too. He's mad at Mrs. Jones. She's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking, and he's my friend, and she's a gossip. He's mad at the employer. Unreasonable, unjust, and overbearing. He's probably saying, where the hell were you Monday, Jim? He also threatens to fire me for drinking and padding my expense account. He's mad at his wife. She misunderstands and nags, and she likes old Brown, and she wants the house put in her name. Now, you tie together liking Brown and wanting the house put in her name, it's time to start getting upset about this deal. Very carefully, we finish the second column. When we're through with it, I think what I realized was that it's not really the people I'm mad at. It's what they did that's got me upset. Because you see, I can take Mr. Brown out of here, and I can put Mr. Green in there, and I'd be just as mad at Green as I am at Brown if he did the same thing. I can take my wife out of here and put my girlfriend in here, and I'll be just as mad at her as she does the same thing. So the first thing I realized in column 2, it's not them. It's what they did that's got me upset. A girlfriend in here. And I'll be just as mad at her as she does the same thing. So the first thing I realized in column 2, it's not them, it's what they did that's got me upset. That's a very valuable piece of information for me to know a little bit later on.
Ready?
Ready?
No, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, let's look at the third column, or the third instruction. He said, in most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationship, including sex, were hurt or threatened, so we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? We go to that third column, and the first thing we do is work the self-esteem column from top to bottom, looking to see beside each injury, was it a threat to our self-esteem? Did it make us appear little in our eyes, or did it make us appear little in the eyes of other people? And if so, we put a check mark in the self-esteem column. Then we go back and we work the second column, and on the second column, we check to see if it was a threat to a personal relationship, and we work it from top to bottom. Then we go to the security instinct, work the material from top to bottom, emotional from top to bottom, then to the sex instinct, acceptable from top to bottom, hidden from top to bottom, and then each ambition top to bottom. And as we do this, I think we're going to begin to see a certain pattern beginning to develop. Many of us will find that most of our problem is self-esteem. Some of us may find that our major problem lies in the area of material security. Some of us may find that it stems from the sex instinct. More likely, we'll find that it comes from all three, but with probably one of them being predominant in the actual thing that it's coming from, the part of self. And we can begin to see the part of self that really drives us and creates these problems. As I finish up column three, I suddenly realize it's not them I'm mad at. It's not what they did I'm mad at, but it's my own reaction to it based upon the basic instincts of life. And for the first time, I see where anger comes from. I've always tried to do something about it, knowing it's always been a problem, but could never do anything about it because I really didn't know where it came from. But when I realize that it stems from the three basic instincts of life, and that I myself can do nothing to control it, then I can begin to see what I might have to do in order to start trying to get rid of it. Realizing that anger, resentment blocks me off from God's will and will eventually cause me to get drunk. Let's see what Bill did with column three. He's mad at Mr. Brown because of his attention to my wife. Well, now that's a threat to our sex relations. You know, if my wife gets to fooling with Brown, finds out old Brown's better than I am, she may cut me off at home entirely. It's a threat to my self-esteem. What are people going to think about me if my wife starts fooling around with Brown and it becomes common knowledge? We're mad at him because he told my wife and my mistress. Now, that sure as hell a threat to sex relations. As soon as my wife found out about the mistress, she cut me off at home, being right there. But she didn't quit there. She went over and got hold of the mistress. And by the time all that deal was over, my mistress has cut me off also, and I have no sex relations at all. It's also a threat to my self-esteem. What are people going to think about me now? In my community, after all, I do teach Sunday school. I'm the leader of the Boy Scouts. And everybody thinks I'm an upstanding citizen. Now what are they going to think about me now that this thing has become public knowledge? You don't think that's important? You talk to Jim Baker. You'll find out it damn sure is. He's also mad at Brown because he might get my job at the office. Well, that's a threat to security. No job, no money. No money, nothing to drink on. No money for a mistress or anything else. This screws me up entirely. It's also a threat to my self-esteem. I've had that job for years, and now Brown's undercut me, and if he takes it away from me, what are people going to think about me now? And very carefully, we fill out that third column, and we begin to learn some very important things about ourselves as to why we react with anger and where it really comes from. Joe?
Oh,
how well we're going to be able to go. It says, on our grudge list. Again, he repeats his instructions again. Although they are right, they're quite plainly there at the bottom of page 64. And then he uses the same words. And by the way, the child emphasizes this is not a new inventory. This is just a form to do the inventory, like the big book says, doing the words are all out of the big book. On our grudge list, this is the reason that he repeats the instructions again. We said, object each name, my injuries. That's the cause. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our sex relations, which had been interfered with? For you to find as this example. Okay. We went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty.
Now, we have no quarrel with that statement at the bottom of page 65. We went back through our lives. You see, my stock in trade today, what's up here in my store, if I'm a practicing alcoholic or one just trying to get straightened out, my stock in trade is going to be resentments. That's what's there. But I didn't just get them today. They've been being placed in there all my life. Some of them came from what they did to me yesterday, last week, last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and on and on and on. So as far as resentments are concerned, the main thing that blocks me off from God's will, I have gone back through my entire life. I don't need to list when I graduated from school or where I went to school. What I need to list are those things that block me off from God's will, and I went back through my life on those. I went back through my life on fears. Fears didn't just come today. They came from what happened yesterday, last week, last month, last year, and etc. I went back through my list as far as harms are concerned, we're going to see later on. And I didn't just do them today. No, those harms have been occurring throughout my entire lifetime. So in the areas that really count, I have gone back through my life. Here we can see that we did this with resentments, Joe.
Okay. When we finish, we consider it carefully. The first thing apparent the world is people are often quite wrong. Well, that's not any new information. We have been knowing that they are always wrong. The conclusion that others were wrong as far as we ever got. You know, that's why all we got through the way we did it. The usually outcome was for people to continue to wrong us, and we stayed sore. That's the way it was. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moment of triumph was short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile.
I read that, and I stopped. And I said, I believe I'll look back in my life and see how many hours I've squandered in resentments. And I realized that one of my favorite things in my life, especially when I was drinking, was to get up early in the morning, have a cup of coffee and a drink of whiskey, and turn on my resentment machine and replay what they did to me yesterday, last week, last month, last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15, 20. My God, I could spend an hour doing it every morning. Just loved it. And when I got through running the resentment machine, another drink of whiskey, another cup of coffee, and then turn on my get-even machine. Well, by God, when they do that again, I'm going to say this, and they're going to say that, and they're going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and then by God, I'll sock them, I'll lay it on them. They're not going to treat me that way. Now, I found the only difference after I sobered up was that I didn't have the drink of whiskey. But I still had the cup of coffee, and still played the resentment and the get-even machine. And I tried to see, how much time have I done this? You know, when I am filled with deep resentment, I'm paralyzed. I really can't do anything worthwhile at all. And I realize that I have spent literally thousands and thousands and thousands of hours doing this. And to the best of my ability, I can't see where it ever did me any good whatsoever. It sure didn't make any money for me. It never straightened up a relationship with another human being. It never made me any happier. It only made me sicker and sicker and sicker. And when I could really see that, I said, I've only got so many hours on this earth. And most of mine's already gone. And I don't intend to waste any of those that I've got left in resentments anymore. I would like for the rest of my life to be peaceful, happy, serene, and free, and useful for some purpose. And if I'm going to let it be filled with resentment, then I'm really not any good for anything at all. That's a bad deal. But that isn't the worst thing. Here's the worst thing with the resentment. And with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. You see, a resentment effectively blocks us off from God's will. And we feel restless and irritable and discontented. And we're mad and we're upset. And we're making decisions based upon resentments, and we don't feel good and we want to feel better. And the obsession of the mind begins to return and say, Charlie, it really wasn't that bad. Charlie, you not like them other people. Surely now that you've been sober 90 days, you could have one drink. And the next thing you know, I become insane. I believe the lie. I think I can drink. And I take a drink. And I trigger the allergy. And with me, to drink is to die. That's the worst thing about a resentment. It causes people like me to get drunk. Now then, if we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. You see, that's why you've got to have a written inventory. With no written inventory, you wouldn't have any list to turn back to. If you had a mental inventory, you already would have lost it. Now I'm going to go back to that list, and I'm going to look at it again. And I'm going to look at it from an entirely different angle. When I first wrote it down, I looked at it to see what those suckers had done to me. Now then, I'm going to look at it from the angle of what are those resentments doing to me. Now, it's no longer a question of who's right and who's wrong. It's no longer a question of whether a resentment is justified or unjustified. The only question in my mind today is, what does a resentment do to me? And if it causes me to drink, then I can no longer afford to have it. It may be the dubious luxury of normal people, but for me, it's going to kill me. So the only question in my mind today is, if this thing's going to kill me, then what can I do about it? And my book says we begin to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. And I read that, and I stopped again, and I thought, oh, my God. Now, I'm the guy that's always been proud of the fact that I stand on my own two feet. Nobody tells me what to do. I make my own decisions, and I run my own show. And I suddenly realized that other people have had control of my thinking all my life through my resentments toward them. And if they control the way I think, then they control the decisions I make, and they control the actions that I take, and they have entire control of my entire life. And I never did know that. I always thought I ran the show. They ran the show for me through my resentments toward them. And about the time I realized that, I thought, oh, Jesus Christ. Golly. Some of these people have been dead and buried 25, 30 years. And they've been reaching out from the grave, and they've had me by the yang-yang all my life. And when I realized that, I said, I am through with resentments. I no longer intend to let those people live in my head rent-free. I've made a decision to let God control my thinking.
Yeah.
And how can he control it if other people control it through my resentment toward them? And it doesn't make any difference whether it's a justified resentment or an unjustified resentment. One of them will kill me just as fast as the other. So that's the day I really begin to see why I need to get rid of these things. Okay. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered by hell. We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. You know, they come from self-will. God made self-will. And only God can overcome self-will. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. And they really are. Everybody operates on self-will to a certain extent, some more than others. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. I hear over and over and over about the third step prayer. I never hear anybody talking about the fourth step prayer. If I want to get rid of a resentment, in many cases it looks like I might have to start praying for those very people that I resent. Simple, but not easy. A price has to be paid. It means the destruction of self-centeredness, Joe.
Okay. We avoid retirement argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kind and tolerant view to each and every one. Okay. Yeah. Well, we have time. We have a little going. Getting my time. Okay, now, here, as we said, we got a tool to get rid of these resentments. And we see there's a key word in the back of the book, at the end of this, not in the back of the book, in the end of this chapter, that's very, very eye-opening in the resentment process. We've always, around AA, talked a lot about writing down your resentments. But we see that the process is a lot more than writing down your resentments. Just to fill out this sheet. Now, one word he uses, he said, not we list and analyze our resentments. Just putting them down, the resentments wouldn't help much. Making a list of them might make it worse. But if we use this process, we can analyze each resentment and get down to the real truth. And you know, and the truth will set us free. Because that's really, we're going to learn what we've been doing, these resentments is not truthful. This is not true. And we're going to list and analyze each resentment. Now, once we when we list and analyze and follow each of these across, put down the name, the cause, find out which part of self was involved, and once we analyze it and see the true picture of each resentment, a lot of those resentments are going to leave us. 90% of them, 95% of them will leave us when we see the real true picture. Number one, I think most of us alcoholics, every alcoholic I know is a pretty intelligent person. And we like, I don't know about other people, but we like to think ourselves as intelligent people. And one thing, when you listen and analyze these resentments, like the big book tells you, about 95% of them look double dumb. I mean, they really do. Yeah. They really look dumb.
So this is the first time we've ever truthfully,
that's right,
morally looked at these things.
They look dumb. It just looks stupid, you know. And it hurts our ego, you know, think that we're doing this and been doing it all these years. So we'll get rid of 95% of them, just maybe 99% of them, just by using this inventory in the big book. But some of them will stay. Very few of them, but some deep resentments will stay. And we ought to pray, use prayer on those. Now, there's an illustration in the back of the book. What's the page, Charlie? 5. Freedom of Story, Freedom from Bondage. 551, the third edition. A great illustration, and we're going to read this right quick if we can. It's one of the classic examples of the use of the inventory in the big book and how to use prayer on resentments. And she says, I've had many spiritual experiences since I've been in the program, many that I didn't recognize right away, for I'm slow learning, they take many guises. But one was so outstanding, I would like to pass it on whenever I can, and hopefully it'd be helpful to someone else as it has me. As I said earlier, self-pity and resentment were my constant companions, and my inventory began to look like a 33-year diary, for I seemed to have resentments against everyone I had ever known. All but one responded to the treatment suggested in the steps immediately, but this one posed a problem. All of them was able to analyze out but one. And she said, it was against my mother. It was 25 years old. I had fed it and fanned it and nurtured it as one might a delicate child. It had become as much a part of me as my breathing. It provided me with excuses for my lack of education, my marital failures, my personal failures, inadequacy, and of course my alcoholism. And though I really thought I was willing to part with it, now I was reluctant to let it go. I love that. One morning, however, I realized I had to get rid of it, for my reprieve was running out, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, and I didn't want to get drunk anymore. In my prayers that morning, I asked God to point out me some way to be free of this resentment. During the day, a friend of mine brought me some magazines to a hospital group I was interested in. I looked through them, and a banner across the front, one featured an article by a prominent clergyman in which I caught the words, resentment. He said, in effect, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you pray for the person or thing you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them and your prayers are only words and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. That's easy enough, isn't it? Do it every day for 2 weeks, and you will find that you have come to mean it and want it for them. You will realize that where there used to be bitterness, resentment, and hatred, you will feel compassionate, understanding, and love. This will work on those deep-seated prayers, deep-seated resentments. Prayer will work. There's no way that resentment and prayer can exist, coexist. These things cannot coexist, regardless of how deep they are. And if, as we, Charlie and I say, if you got a resentment against somebody and you really want to keep it, please don't pray about it. Because if you do, you're going to lose it.
I had a resentment that I hated a fellow with a purple passion. I think I probably would have been glad to do away with him if I could have done it without getting caught. And I got to this stage of the program, and I remember again talking to my sponsor about it. And he said, Charlie, you got to get rid of that resentment. And I said, I don't want to get rid of it. He said, that's beside the point. He said, if you don't, it's going to cause you to get drunk. And I said, well, how do you do that? He said, let me show you. And he took me back here and showed me this example in the book. And he said, now go home and do what it says, and you can get rid of that resentment. And I went home and I got down on my knees, which I very seldom did in those days, and I said, God, I want you to give that son of a bitch everything he deserves. And that's the only prayer I had for him that day. But 3 or 4 or 5 days later, I found myself saying, God, I'd like for you to give to that fellow what I would like in my own life. Give him the peace of mind, the serenity, and the happiness that I seek for myself. And some 3 or 4 or 5 days later after that, I don't really know when, I woke up one morning, and that resentment was gone. And it has never come back. It really does work. I think the irony of that whole situation is that that fellow is now my next door neighbor. And we visit with each other almost every day. And we smile and we laugh and we tell jokes and we're good friends and we visit in each other's homes quite often. This thing really does work if we want it to work. And I think what we got to realize is, sometimes we don't want to get rid of these resentments because sometimes we can use them to justify things. Just like the one in this story used that resentment against her mother to justify her lack of education. Used it as an excuse for her marital failure. Used it as an excuse for being an alcoholic. As she gets rid of that resentment, she won't have that excuse anymore. And many times we use resentments to rationalize, justify, and excuse ourselves and cover up for our weaknesses, for our things that we've done in the past by blaming other people. Let's briefly look at an example of that and then we'll quit for the day. Go to page 67, third paragraph. It says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. Now, the fourth column on your inventory sheet, if you'll now unfold it,
fourth column,
we'll see that it is headed up as, what is the exact nature of my wrongs, faults, mistakes, defects, or shortcomings? Now, we already know what the wrong is. You know, incorrect judgment is considered to be a wrong. Anything that blocks us off from God's will is considered to be a wrong. Now, the resentment is the wrong. But what's the exact nature of it? And again, I had to go to my dictionary, because to me, nature was birds and bees and trees and things like that. And that didn't make any sense. So I looked up the word nature, and again, I found several definitions. But I think I found the one that he's talking about. Nature of something is the inherent characteristic of it. What is at the core of it? Now, the resentment is the wrong, but what's the inherent characteristic of that wrong? What is within me that causes this resentment in the first place? Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened, and inconsiderate? Remember in step three he said that we invariably find that we've made a decision based on self, which later put us in a position to be hurt. And I begin to read these things now from left to right to see the part that I had played, disregarding the other people. Now, the guy that I hated, his name was Vic. And the cause of it was that he and I went in business together, and one day he absconded with the funds. Now, that was a threat to the social instincts, to the security instinct, and certainly to my ambitions in those areas. And I was absolutely infuriated with him. That's all I'd been able to see is what he did. But now my book said, forget what he did, Charlie. Look at what you did. What part did you play in it? And I suddenly realized that Vic didn't come to me. I went to him. And I went to Vic because of two reasons. Number one, he had some money that I didn't have. And number two, he knew, had some knowledge I didn't have. And I talked him into being my partner. Now, this does not excuse him. But it shows me how I, for selfish reasons, conned Vic into being my partner. How I placed myself in the position to be hurt at a later date. I was completely inconsiderate of his welfare. I could have cared less whether he made any money or not. I went into it strictly for my own selfish reasons. And I begin to see that that is my personality. That's what had developed throughout my entire lifetime from living a life on self-will, that I had become a very selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened, and inconsiderate human being. Now, the instant I realized that, then my resentment really began to disappear. And I felt kind of stupid. And I had my wife's name, Barbara, on here. Now, those of you today that know Barbara and I know that we we've got a new marriage. We've fallen in love again. But there was a time that it wasn't that way. About 18 years ago, we were in a hell of a shape. Well, Barbara would say, Charlie, you ain't nothing but a damned alcoholic. And I'd say, woman, you crazy as hell. And we got into AA and Al-Anon, we found out we were both right all along. But I had her on here as one I resented. And the cause of the resentment was, the last year I drank, she filed for divorce 3 times. She's spending more on money than I ever thought on lawyers than I ever thought about spending on booze. And that was a threat to my social instinct, self-esteem, personal relationship, threat to my security, both material and emotional, threat to my sex life, threat to my ambitions. I just checked nearly every one of those. But then I looked to see the part that I had played. Where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened and inconsiderate? If I hadn't been so selfish, I wouldn't have been out there doing some of the things that I was doing. If I hadn't been so dishonest, I wouldn't have been lying to her all the time. If I hadn't been so self-seeking and frightened, here I was about 36 years old, and I knew that I was getting older fast, and if I didn't get all of it in while I could get it in, I'd be too old to get it in the future. And because of fear, I began to do things that I shouldn't be doing outside of my marriage. If I'd been more considerate of my wife and my children, I wouldn't have been doing those things in the first place. And if I hadn't have been doing them, then Barbara wouldn't have filed for divorce in the first place. You see, I'd never looked at the part I played. And I suddenly realized why I love resentments. You see, when I would do something wrong, and they would retaliate against me, and then I would resent them for what they did. And every time I played that over in my head, they got worse and worse, and I got better and better. And if I can play it long enough, I can make them the culprit in every case, and I can make myself as pure as the driven snow. Through rationalization, through resentments, I can shift all blame from me to other people. My God, if you're a practicing alcoholic, you've got to learn to develop those skills. We can't live with ourselves if we could honestly look at those things. Uh-uh.